Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning, it's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, the physical toll of running a 250-mile marathon. And how Reggie Watts blends music and comedy. But first, it is time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
The deliberation between principals in our national security apparatus about whether or not to strike another country, would you consider that to be classified information?
Pre-decisional strike deliberation should be conducted through classified channels.
Thank you.
It's in our Constitution. They put it in there for a reason. I believe in it. I don't think that a few bad actors should take it out for everyone.
Today, there's no more pretending. This bill will cost Arizona taxpayers $1 billion, even as amended. And the Diamondbacks won't be paying half. In fact, they're not required to pay a single dollar.
The administration has been working for months to implement these administrative changes to the program that'll both save taxpayer dollars and ensure that we're delivering critical health care to Arizonans with disabilities.
We've doubled the number of parents in the program in the last 18 months, but she shows no growth to pay for this in the next 3 years. It just doesn't add up.
He left the ladder down for others to climb, lifting up his colleagues, moving us to stand up for what's right, always in the name of those who couldn't stand up for themselves.
And with me to talk about the field to replace the late Congressman Raul Grijalva shaping up, a plan to ask voters to end some legislative immunity fizzling, and more, are Marcus Dellartino of First Strategic. Good morning, Marcus.
Good morning.
And Democratic strategist Tony Connie. Tony, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So I've got to ask, Tony, are you surprised that Adrian Fontes, Secretary of State, decided not to run for Congress?
I am surprised, but only because I convinced myself that he was going to run, not for any other reason. He obviously has a very important job. I'm glad that now Democrats will have a Secretary of State running for re-election. I think that puts us in a stronger position than if he had moved over to this other congressional race. I'm glad that he made this decision because I do think it's good just to have him in that office.
Marcus, the Secretary had said he was strongly considering it, and it was the conventional wisdom, which of course can be wrong, was that he was getting in. He was just waiting for the right moment to get in. And then this week he said, well, there's this executive order from the White House on elections, election security. I need to stay in my current job and deal with that.
Well, what Republicans are wondering is why he hates his current job so much, because every time a position comes open, he floats his name out there that he's running for it. So I wasn't surprised from this context, and that is if the fastest way to lose in a Pima County race, which this is largely Pima County, mm-hmm. running all the way over to Yuma, is to be from Maricopa County. And I think he was going to get labeled with that, regardless of the fact that he grew up in Nogales and was at the Yuma Proving Grounds in the military. That just wasn't going to be enough, I don't think, at the end of the day to carry in Pima.
All right. So we do know this week that Daniel Hernandez, former state lawmaker, he ran for Congress, I believe, in the primary once before. He is getting into the race. How strong of a candidate is he?
Well, I think that, I don't want to be too critical of him because that's unfair, but I don't think he's that strong of a candidate. He lost in the primary to Engel by a pretty wide margin down
Kirsten
there.
Kirsten Engel, then lost to Juan Sisgamani.
Who then lost to Juan Sisgamani. And so, and I think that, Adelita Grijalva, who the assumption is going to run, she has a history of winning elections down there. She has a track record. She's done work. Plus, she's got the name ID just from her dad. Like, so it's not like she's so I just think that she's a very strong candidate. It's a Democratic primary. It's going to be low turnout, so anything can happen. But I wouldn't put him as the favorite personally.
Would you put Grijalva as the favorite? Assuming she gets in,
yes,
is she the favorite?
I would.
Is that the race in terms of high profile candidates? Or is it those two? Do you think?
I think it's probably going to be just those two.
Marcus, do you think anybody? Do you think Adelita Grijalva, the late congressman's daughter, gets in?
I think that's a conventional wisdom, and I think that the conventional wisdom is that she's the strongest candidate. But I can't help but sort of reflect back to, it reminds me a little bit of Ed Pastor and Laura Pastor. And I think that she, going into that race, everybody thought Laura had it hands down. and obviously didn't. And so I wonder if there's sort of going to be that sort of backlash down in Pima County, or because of that district's different, maybe they welcome her with open arms.
And this is a very Democratic-leaning district. So whoever wins the Democratic primary is almost certainly going to win the general election. I guess I'm curious, Marcus, like, are you surprised that there aren't more people, more high-profile people who have been involved in politics, maybe won elections before getting in? And this is an open congressional seat. And again, conventional wisdom is whoever wins this can probably stay in that seat for as long as they want it.
Yeah, but I also think that the context I think that we're missing here is that I think Rahul Grijalva spent years setting this up, sort of keep people out of the race when he passed or when he decided to step down so that he can hand it to his daughter. The only question is, is the electorate onto that and not happy with sort of what we would call nepotism?
Well,
want to move on to a different candidate. I don't know.
I understand what you're saying, but I do think this is a different situation in the sense that, like, she has served, you know, very well at a school board level. She's at the county supervisor level. Like, she has established herself. She has her own credentials, and she is well liked. I think the reason people aren't jumping in is because the strength of her candidacy. Hmm. And it is a thing that you know that just because you have the same last name as somebody else doesn't mean that you're going to win. The fact that people are not brave enough, that's a weird way to say it, but are not making the decision to jump in is a sign of her strength. I think that if it was just this idea that it's just the name, I think more people would be jumping in. But I think that she's a strong candidate down there.
So you're saying if she had said, I'm not running, or if she wasn't involved in politics, there would be more people involved.
Yes, I think that. Yeah.
Okay. Marcus, let me ask you about a proposal at the Capitol to basically make it so that lawmakers who speed during session get ticketed and aren't able to get out of it. This would have to go to the voters. It's in the state constitution that legislators have immunity during session. There is a proposal to ask voters to do away with it just for traffic violations, and it does not look like it's going to be put to voters.
Yeah, big shock. So, you know, the context is obviously we've been through a couple high-profile stories about legislators speeding and getting out of their tickets. Largely, I think the majority of those were in the Senate. And so a representative in the House of Representatives put forward a ballot measure that would go to voters that stripped that immunity away. And it made it through the House. But as I predicted a couple of weeks ago, I think it was going to fall flat in the Senate. And certainly it has fallen flat in the Senate.
Is that a like, optically, is that a problem for the people who are writing the laws to say we don't want to ask voters if we should have to follow them?
I think we give things more credit than the voters do. And I think in this particular case, they're infuriated at the time it happens. And that infuriation lasts for, you know, a week or two.
Mm-hmm.
But when you get to the ballot and you're consumed with economic issues or national security issues or whatever is the flavor of the day, maybe it's education, that has a tendency to sort of drop off. You know, you're not thinking about legislative immunity half as much as how to put food on the table.
Tony, are you surprised that it kind of fell apart in the Senate?
Yeah, I'm surprised because a Republican put it forward. I thought that maybe that would help it get through. But there's a lot of weird things that are happening in the Senate right now, decisions that don't make sense. I don't know exactly why this is. I mean, I know why it's not proceeding. It's because people want to have this immunity. And Mark Fincham, one of the senators who basically said, I don't have to pay for a ticket, my speeding ticket, because, you know, I'm a legislator. This is it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. Like, clean it up. Like, don't abuse this. They're too, you know, you've got the president of the Senate who clearly is just chasing Fox News headlines right now because he's running for attorney general. He's focusing on that stuff and not these simple common sense things that, like, it would pass. The voters would approve it whether or not they're upset or not, because it would be a very simple thing. They'd be like, oh, yeah, I'm for this. But they decided they didn't want to put it before people, even though it's widely popular with voters.
Well, and I don't, you know, for context here, the president of the Senate did the job he's supposed to do, which is assign it to a committee. And it's up to the committee chairman what bills they're going to hear and what they're going to move forward. And just so happens in this particular case, it went to a committee where the chairman didn't see eye to eye on that particular issue.
So something else going on at the Capitol, there's been some fights over supplemental funding requests. Basically, you know, the budget is passed for the beginning of the fiscal year. And then, you know, in some cases, more money is needed for particular programs. And in this case, there are two of them, one dealing with congregate care for the Division of Child Safety, one for a program for people with developmental disabilities. Governor Hobbs this week, Tony, laid out some administrative changes, she's calling them, to especially a program where parents are able to get paid to care for their kids who have developmental disabilities. This is a program that it could run out of money like in the next month or so. And this has turned into a really big fight at the Capitol, with Republicans accusing the governor of fiscal mismanagement, set up a whole ad hoc committee to try to look at this. The governor says, OK, I'm going to put some new requirements in place, some new restrictions in place. You guys need to pass the supplemental funding bill. Doesn't seem like that's really on the offing at this point.
No, this is it's good politics for the Republicans to hold this money up. I don't know if it is. I think that it is a sign that there's just a major lack of empathy in the decisions that they're making. There are real people's lives in the balance here. And it's not like they haven't done these supplementals in the past, right? Like, many, I hear them complaining about this. And I think if you don't hear the context, people who heard at the beginning of the show, are they talking about vouchers? Are they talking about ESAs? Like, the way that, like, it's not, you know, it's just a blank check and we're not budgeting for this. And there's been supplementals in the past to shore up the ESA situation. And so I think they should just act on this. Look, you can still campaign. If you're listening, Republicans, you can still campaign on this. Just help save people. Do the right thing. Get this done.
Well, so Marcus, Republicans are saying they are happy to put money into this, but it has to be part of the overall budget package for the fiscal year that starts on July 1st. The problem is this program is supposedly or projected to run out of money much before that, and it doesn't seem as though lawmakers and the governor are particularly close to passing a budget.
Let's give this thing some context here. One, Tony's right. I mean, we do supplementals all the time, so don't get fooled by the word supplemental. Two, this is a program that sort of during COVID was implemented so that parents could take care of these kids or these folks, I guess I should say. And so the question is, it's exploded in growth, as you can imagine. And so they're set to run out of money. I do ultimately, at the end of the day, I think there will be resolution. But, you know, it does, from a Republican standpoint, is all these budget proposals need to be taken in to context with one another as we look at a whole budget. And so I know that there's budget negotiations happening now. I am hopeful that we get done sooner rather than later, although I'm hopeful but also realistic about where that's headed. But ultimately, at the end of the day, I think that these folks will get taken care of and they'll reach a resolution there.
Marcus, let me ask you about a proposal moving through the legislature that would ban lobbyists from serving as governor. This is being supported by Jake Hoffman, a state senator that we speak of often on this program, who is a big supporter of Andy Biggs, who is a member of Congress, who is running for governor. He is not such a huge fan of Karen Taylor Robeson, who is also running for governor and is registered as a lobbyist. He is saying it's not specifically about Karen Taylor Robeson, Marcus, but it seems kind of hard to believe that it wouldn't be.
I'm pretty sure it is. And first of all, let me say, I'm heartbroken that I will not be able to run for governor.
Governor Dellertino would have been great.
man, would we get some stuff done quick. But listen, the media is sort of portraying this as this bill is moving. And I just want, just for some context here, it's Mr. Hoffman's bill being heard in Mr. Hoffman's committee. So, of course, it got heard in committee. But it's got a long, long, long way to go. You know, it's got to get through rules. It's got to go through a full vote of the Senate and back to the House and be agreed to. So, honestly, at the end of the day, I don't think this one sort of makes it all the way through the process. But it is accomplished its goal, which really was to tell the story that, you know, Karen Robeson Taylor was a lobbyist.
Is this, I mean, even if it doesn't actually get to the voters, like, what is the impact of a bill like this? I mean, as you mentioned, it sort of served the goal of making sure voters know that Karen Taylor Robeson has served as a lobbyist or is a registered lobbyist
for 25 years.
But it also, like, it's optically.
I'll do you one better. The allegation is she worked for APS, a power company. So she worked to make sure that we had a reliable power source so that we could have a booming economy in Arizona and data centers that it turns out that half of these people's livelihood depends on, because they're all using social media to get their messages out. So,
but the reason why this has become a flared-up situation isn't because she worked for APS, which, of course, has raised utility rates, and that's actually what lobbyists focus on. It's because she is campaigning as though she is an outsider who is a business person. Her business is lobbying. She's not being hired to fix somebody's bottom line, like, as a business person. She's being hired to get government to do something. And so, personally, I think this is a dumb proposal. If voters want to pick a lobbyist of a coal mine and utility companies like Robeson to be governor, they should have that choice. It shouldn't be taken away from them.
Or a hospital or schools or any of the other
great
things.
But that's not what the situation is with Robeson. But one group of people that I know for sure believes that Arizonans don't want a lobbyist to be their governor is the Robeson campaign. And that is why they are so cautious about never saying what she does for a living and instead couching it as though she's a business person.
She's a land planner, for God's sakes. I mean, that's how she actually made her money, is doing development. Here's what's really going on is that Democrats want to target her right out of the gate because they want to run against Andy Biggs. And I'll tell you, either one of them is a flawed strategy.
Although, I mean, we should point out, this is, as you referenced, this is not a Democratic proposal. This is a Republican proposal by a supporter of Robeson's primary opponent.
Sure. No secret that Mr. Hoffman, loves Andy Biggs and wants him to be governor. And my guess is thinks that he has a seat in that administration.
I mean, I think Biggs is terrible, too, if I'll just tell you as a Democrat. I think that they're both not super strong candidates.
I think
whatever.
It's safe to say you're not voting for either, though.
Right. The point is, Democrats are pointing this out because we want to win an election, and we want voters to know that one of the candidates for governor is misrepresenting. And I guess Hoffman feels the same way.
All right. So sort of not really the same subject, but another proposal in the legislature that is generating a lot of controversy is one about what is known as stolen valor, which is when somebody basically says they served in the military and didn't, or tries to misrepresent their military service, something like that. Marcus, there's a bill that would basically say if you do that, you can't run for office. This was an issue in the last election, and it's not getting through the legislature the way that a lot of people thought it would.
No, and this one dates back to the last election, and there's a lot of intrigue and drama in it. But first of all, I should tell you, I don't think we should be telling people who can and who can't run for office. I think that's probably a bad idea. Let the voters decide. But in this particular case, Representative Blackmun had an opponent in his race who was accused of using stolen valor, which is, I'm a veteran and did X, Y, and Z in the military, and it turns out that that's not exactly true.
And Representative Blackmun did serve in the military.
That is, yes. Tank driver, as he is very proud to tell you. The opponent lost the primary race to Mr. Blackmun, but was also dear friends and very close to Wendy Rogers, and it got very visceral up there in Northeast Arizona concerning this race. So when Mr. Blackmun won, he came down here and ran a bill that says, if you're found guilty of stolen valor, then you can't run for office. That bill made it through the House, went over to the Senate, and was assigned to Ms. Rogers' committee. And as we talked previously, the chairman of the committee gets to pick which bills go up and which bills don't. And she held the bill, I think it was this week, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, she was kind of a procedural trick. There were a ton of veterans, Republicans and Democrats, that were in there ready to testify. And she, pulled it. She pulled it off the agenda. And it didn't just get through the House. It passed unanimously in the House, now twice, because a Republican member of the House did this thing called a striker to put it back up again. And so there are enough votes, probably on that committee, definitely on the Senate floor, to pass this. But when it came to the decision of whether or not this would go to a vote, Warren Peterson, who's the president of the Senate, just said no. And I just don't – it's one of those things I just don't understand why he continually is so afraid of standing up to Wendy Rogers. There's pressure – I think that – I don't know why she's a committee chair,
frankly. You keep picking on President Peterson, and I know you're doing it because he's running for attorney general. But
By the way, don't look at my Twitter. I have never picked on President Peterson for a couple of years before he was running for attorney general. So
the conversation is devoid of the president's responsibility and job as president of the Senate. His job is to assign it to committee. He did that to the proper committee. It's up to the chairman
to decide that. So he made a statement just yesterday saying that there would not be a vote on the floor of the Senate with the striker. That's something he could do, though, right?
How is he going to move the striker that didn't get into committee assignment?
Well, so let me ask this. Is this more a policy issue, or is this more of a personality issue. Marcus, you referenced that the candidate that was sort of the impetus for this is good friends with Senator Rogers. Is it more a personality or more of a policy dispute here?
I assume it's personality. I'm not too sure what the policy would be. There has to be a reason, but I'm not too sure what that is. It wasn't expressed, I don't think, in committee this week.
Well, she said that there's confidential information that would come out, which was proven to not be true. She also said that she talked to Blackmun's staff or had, you know, to come with some of her compromise, which he said wasn't true. I think that it is just that she doesn't want to give him a win.
All right. So, guys, let's go to D.C. For our last couple of minutes here. Hearings this week, which kind of turned into a conversation about what is known as Signal Gate. At some point, we're going to stop putting gate at the end of everything, I guess.
I don't know. No,
or maybe we're not. It's been it's been since the 70s, so we're probably not at this point. You're right, Marcus. We saw that Senator Mark Kelly had some pretty interesting questions for some of the folks from the intelligence community. Both he and Representative Greg Stanton are calling for the Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, to resign over this. I'm assuming that he's not going to. But, Tony, is this like a political like way to sort of nudge the administration, sort of pick at the administration a little bit?
No, I think this is a shocking development, the fact that this happened. They were on this, you know, chat. And you know, I think that it is a legitimate national security problem. And even, you know, and even if there was no classified information, though, I think that the evidence is that there was, it shows a level of carelessness, right? And like, you know, some people are saying, oh, how did this reporter even get in this chat? Maybe he tricked them to get in. Here's the thing. If a senior citizen is tricked into giving their money away because of a text message, they're a victim. If a senior intelligence official is tricked, they're reckless. This is the kind of thing that they need to be careful about. My best friend from high school was big in the Obama administration when it comes to national security. And he says that, like, when he's talking to people, they're just aghast. They can't believe this is even an issue. They should have just accepted responsibility and said, we won't do this anymore. And it probably would go away. And so, but the fact they've been denying this has been doing it. And I do think that, you know, now Ruben Gallego has called for this. And many Republicans in the Senate have spoken up saying, like, hey, this is not great, even though they're not calling for resignation. And so I do think that this is, like, one of those moments where the reaction, where they're just denying it, is scary. And, you know, I think that it signals what's going to happen going forward.
Marcus, obviously with a caveat that none of us are in the intelligence community in this room, I don't think.
That
If you are, you've not told me, which means you're doing your job. but, like, do you agree with Tony that this is not so much just a political issue, but a legit national security issue?
I would first of all, you know, the senators are doing what senators – I mean, this is like politics 101, right? Of course you're going to call for a resignation. And if the tables were turned, the Republicans would be doing the exact same thing. So no surprises there, number one. And number two is, you know, there are applications out there that the U.S. military uses for secure conversations.
Yeah, there's a whole infrastructure.
That's a fact of life.
And Signal is not one of them.
And Signal is not one of them. And so I do think that, to Tony's point, the fastest way to politically solve this for Republicans is accept responsibility quickly and move on and pivot to other issues and not use it anymore for that conversation. Use those secure channels, which, by the way, the U.S. taxpayers paid for. So go ahead and use the asset that you've already paid for.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. Marcus Dellertino, Tony Connie, thanks you both for coming in. Really appreciate the conversation.
Thank you, Mark.
Happy to be here.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, would you rather see live comedy or live music? How Reggie Watts combines the two in a genre-bending performance. But first, if you think running a marathon sounds exhausting, wait till you hear about the world of ultra-marathons. Ultra-marathons are days-long races of upwards of 100 miles. Arizona is home to one of the most intimidating ultra-marathons, the Coca Dona. It's a whopping 250-mile trek that begins in Black Canyon City and ends in Flagstaff. Runners traverse mountains, forests, waterways, and vast stretches of desert over the course of the race, and they do it all on very little sleep. They have about 5 days to complete the course, which means you basically have to run two marathons a day for 5 days, but many of them do it even faster. A new documentary film called The Chase tells the story of five people who competed in last year's Coca-Dota. The film screens tomorrow at ASU's Herberger Center, and my co-host Sam Dingman recently caught up with director Dylan Harris and one of the runners in the film, Jeff Browning.
I saw Coca-Dota develop. I moved to Flagstaff the first year, the first race. So it immediately became a huge part of my life since I'm an ultra running coach and, you know, still racing ultras. I saw it quickly become an iconic race in the 200 scene. I knew pretty quickly that I was going to run that race.
Yeah,
I guess.
Well, and just to clarify, when you're saying the 200 scene, is that 200 miles and above?
Yeah, the 200, the 200 plus distance.
Wow. Well, so it strikes me that running a race like this puts you in a pretty vulnerable place, physically, mentally, emotionally. Did you have any hesitations about participating in a documentary like this where there would be cameras on you during some of those moments?
No. I mean, I like the pressure. As an athlete, I think it when, you know, the cameras are on, you have to rise to the occasion, and it gives you more skin in the game even than if there weren't cameras.
Dylan, let me ask you, how do you approach the difficult task of potential documentary sources generally when you know that there are going to be these really vulnerable moments? And what was that like on this project?
A concept I've been playing around with a lot is that making film, I need to be so open-minded to the characters and the opinions and perspectives that I'm capturing. I mean, I was literally living with each of these guys for 3-4 days at a time, eating like them, going on runs with them, little workouts, and meeting their families. So to me, is the more I can be vulnerable and be myself and just let my guard down and allow them to be who they are, the more all of the they can be themselves and not trying to put them all in this ultra runner box.
Jeff, I'm curious, was there anything about your process that was very specific that it felt vulnerable to share with Dylan? Any specific moments where you realized, like, wow, I'm really showing my belly here?
I'm pretty good at wearing my emotions on my shirt sleeve, if you ask my wife.
Okay.
So she always says TMI, too much information. You know, my parents brought me up to be honest, and I don't mind showing that. And yeah. Dylan really dug with good questions, especially when our emotions were raw, like the day after the race. Your guard's way let down.
Yeah.
Right. Because at that point I had really only had probably in 3 days, 8 hours of total sleep. And we were really raw. I mean, onion layers are peeled away during that, after that race. And so, you know, if he digs a little, and we're willing to be a little honest, yeah, he definitely dug some, you know, tears out of my eyes.
Sure. I mean, if you're comfortable saying what was behind those tears, I mean, was it surprising to you that you felt that level of emotion? What were you feeling?
You know, leading for 160 plus miles of that race and losing the lead with 2 miles to go because of a, you know, reactive airway and my airway, you know, swollen and couldn't restrict it and feel like I was breathing through a straw. Really could only nose breathe the last like 60 miles.
My God.
You know, 50, 60 miles. That was really, really a challenge. I had to like overcome it with mindset, all the years of training of mindset, just to keep going and not panic. And, you know, thank gosh, I've read Wim Hof method of breathing.
Can you tell us briefly what that is? I'm not familiar with that.
So it's deep nose breathing. You know, 30 to 40 seconds, 30 to 40 inhales, exhales, and then hold your breath and then rest and for a minute and then do it over and over again, like 3 to 4 sets. It's kind of a meditative breathing process of like teaching yourself to deep nose breathe. So I just focused on that when I couldn't get any air through my airway, through my mouth.
Dylan, let me ask you, I mean, this story that Jeff just shared, and thank you for sharing that, Jeff. I mean, that's an extraordinary narrative for a movie on its own. The idea of somebody leading a race this grueling, this challenging for 160 miles And then the idea of leading any race for 160 miles, it just kind of boggles the mind as a sentence to say. and then, you know, losing that lead, dealing with this breathing issue he was just describing. That's an extraordinary story. And that is just one of five stories that you're telling in this movie, as well as telling the story of the Cocodona more broadly. Can you talk a little bit about what you went into the film thinking it was going to be about and what it was going to focus on and how you adjusted in the moment to developments like that?
So for all five athletes, there was stories of their that were happening in their life, but then also the race itself, because it's so long and there's so many ups and downs, there were also stories that you could find parallels to within the race.
Right.
And so an obvious one for Jeff was that he was coming into Flagstaff, his new hometown, to his family and friends. So there was sort of an obvious one there. I mean, running 250 miles is absurd. It's not just showing up and playing a 90-minute basketball game, you know? And so, like, running for three straight days at the upper echelon of, like, human potential and riding on, you know, 40 minutes of total sleep, it's insane. And for it to end in Flagstaff, which is now his hometown, where he's trying to build new strong relationships, and to have that lead and to know you're trying to bring that home and walk into a victory in front of your new community, and then to lose that right at the end and then have to go and face all those people, but then for them to bring you up, you know, and really like celebrate you and what you did, like, I think that's where the emotion came from.
Well, that makes me think about a memorable moment from the trailer for the film featuring Jeff.
I just nailed it. I think it just would have fed my ego. That's not always what we need. Sometimes it's what we want, but it's not what we need.
Well, Dylan Harris is the director of the documentary film The Chase, and Jeff Browning is one of the runners. The film chronicles the 250-mile ultramarathon, the Cocodona. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
The Road Company of The Cher Show, a musical biography of the famous actress and singer, opens tonight at Mesa Art Center. KJZZ contributor Robert Pala spoke with Cher expert Mary McCrae about what the famous icon means to a whole lot of people.
The Cher Show has come to town, but perhaps more importantly, so has Mary McCrae, who's driven here from her home in New Mexico to see The Cher Show when it opens tonight at Mesa Arts Center. Mary has devoted a big chunk of her adult life to parsing Cher's meaning in popular culture and in using Cher's Cherness as a means of observing women and art and ideas about who they are in the 21st century. She mostly does this through a 26-year-old project called Cher Scholar. Mary McCrae is also, do I need to tell you, a great big giant Cher fan. So in the show, Cher is played by three different actors. Is that right?
It is.
Yeah.
Yes, the show was set up with three different Chers. I'm of two minds about it, though.
Tell me.
Because I kind of think that maybe there should be five Chers.
Five?
Yes. I feel three is not enough. There's a 60s share, there's a 70s share, and then there's an 80s and beyond share. And that seems like a huge, huge piece of work for one share to do. She's never boring.
She's also not really like any other person. So how does Cher represent American women in the 21st century?
A lot of pop stars get the cultural commentary treatment, such as like Taylor Swift now is getting great cultural commentary. Madonna for years has been getting good commentary. But Cher was ridiculed for so many years. There's so much great information to mine about share's cultural meaning now that it would take, I think we could spend an hour just talking about that question you just asked. I think 20 years ago, I did a survey of share fans and non-share fans, and I asked them, what's the word that you think signifies share? And most people said resilience and strength.
Let's talk about the share show, the musical. You've seen it on Broadway.
I did.
Yeah. And does the musical do her justice?
Nobody, nowhere in any universe is going to do Cher justice. But I'm happy it exists. I'm happy there's an artifact out there that is trying to give her meaning.
Okay, so if you were told you could only listen to one Cher song for the rest of your life, what would it be?
Wow. Okay.
Just one.
Just one.
Yeah.
There is a song Sunny wrote that ended up on a 1971 duet album called Somebody, and that would be the song. Do you want me to tell you what I like about that song?
I do.
Well, that song, it starts with wonder. There's the word wonder, and then she references herself in it. She calls herself Cher, which is unprecedented. There's no other song that does that. And then the song just like expands into this open-hearted thing that ends with this gospel choir. It's lovely.
Someone told me long ago, Cher, you just can't see. You miss the forest looking for the tree. When I think about it now, it's very true, you see. 'Cause everything I want is next to me. Somebody.
You know, you've done a lot of work Somebody. To kind of help those of us who like Cher music to see the way she represents other things in the world. You have us thinking about Cher as iconography. But I think the thing that you've done that I enjoy the most is you've forgiven me for liking She's No Better Than Me, which is my favorite Cher song.
It's so typical that you would pick a rare.
I love it. I played
it's a beautiful song.
It is nice. Yeah.
Someone better than me. Now I'm just your you.
That was Robert Pala talking to Mary McCrae, aka Cher Scholar. The Cher Show performs at Mesa Arts Center through March 30th. And you are listening to the show.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Musical comedian Reggie Watts is in Tucson tonight performing at 191 Tool. The phrase one-man band is a bit of a cliche, but it may well be the most accurate way to describe Watts' work. His performances are often completely improvised. It's just him and a handful of synthesizers and loop pedals on stage. Watts comes out, starts monologuing, then segues into musical riffs, then shifts abruptly back to more traditional stand-up. It's a very unique experience, and as he recently told my co-host Sam Dingman, it only works because he takes the musical part of his act seriously.
I love getting stuff right, you know, if I'm going to do something, and I want it to feel like, you know, I know what it is. And, you know, and I genuinely like all forms of music. I kind of just think of it all as one language. I just see it as a one huge human family language. And so the more that I know, you know, whether it's like Irish.
Oh, there she stood on the cliffs of Oreshood. On the mountains did cry her name.
Or, you know, shamanic style music of different cultures, or whether it's modern electronic music.
Get it playing song, fit never never going to mail song. Fit, hell, pound, hit, 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 hit,
I love all of it. So like, I like celebrating that in my performances.
Yeah. That's interesting. It's almost like you're talking about music as part of the language, the way that somebody who's like a traditional stand-up might have a mastery of like accents or dialects or use mm-hmm. idioms a certain way.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, for sure. Well, because music also translates, carries way more information, which can elicit obviously a very large reaction. Words are very powerful, but music has so much more information in it.
Yeah. When you started out performing, was your goal to do the two forms, music and comedy, distinctly, or did you always want your performance persona to blend them together?
I kind of want them to be one thing, although I do like treating them, you know, as separate things as well, because it's fun to, you know, make people forget.
Have you guys ever like made like muffins or anything like that? You know what I'm saying? And you'd be like, how can I spice this up, you know? And then you just take like a bunch of weed and shit, you know, and just like, just throw it in the muffin mix. And then it kind of looks like a really gooey salad or something like that. And you bake it, and it's awful, but it gets you really high. And a couple of your friends think they have to go to the hospital. And you're trying everything to make them not dial 911 because you know that it will pass and no one's ever died of that, of paranoia. Anyway.
So the other component of all this that I want to ask you about is improvisation, because I know that you will build sometimes an entire performance spontaneously. What's exciting to you about the idea of not having a net when you build a whole performance, a whole evening that way?
For me, it's required because I need to know that what I'm doing is what I'm paying attention to. And I don't like being, you know, unconscious about things. And there is just something really rewarding about just going in. I don't have anything planned. I'm going to go in and, you know, do something.
Here's what I think. If you're good to people in general, no matter who they are, then you're just being good to people, okay? And that's a good example that I like to say, that I like to start out with, that I like to begin with, that I like to just get out of the way, because I like to do a lot of things as long as I can do them. As long as I can do them is when I like to say that people throughout history have always had their day. Had they not been the one from the first to the start, it's not to say that they would never know the knocks, knocking things over. Yes, it's the thing you can do when you're moving through a crowd and you can't see the blue of the darkness in the darkness as the millipedes do crawl upon your feet. And yes, you feel as though the roaches, they will bleed. And as you do the thing and the demon does recede from the recesses of your imagination upon stage. And when you see lots of space between the barricade and me, well, that's just an indication of an overprecautiousness by unions, which are important. But I'm just saying.
As a last question, Reggie, I wanted to ask, you are somebody who has been at the vanguard of comedy for quite a while now. And I think of you as somebody who has remained relevant and interesting and revered through a lot of different eras in comedy, you know, whether it's the height of like improv and sketch, whether it was kind of like the rebirth of stand-up and storytelling and that sort of thing. What do you think is kind of the dominant characteristic in comedy right now? And how do you feel about it?
I mean, I don't really know what it is. I think because currently right now with the rise of authoritarianism and the threat of fascism and those types of things, you know, that are more realistic than ever, comedy has a different purpose. You know, comedy changes throughout the decades. It's an opportunity for people to kind of remind human beings of what we're here for, you know, which is creativity, collaboration, helpfulness, solution solving, you know, all of these other traits that are, you know, are essentially viruses, you know, in the human operating system, have to be eradicated. and moved beyond because they serve no one and nothing, and they're primitive, and like we should have been beyond this, you know, decades ago. But it still holds. And so I think comedy and absurdity especially is an incredibly powerful tool because it gets people out of a dread state and shows them hope, which gives them the opportunity to view multiple solutions ahead.
Wow. Reggie, thank you so much.
Yay. Yeah, thank you very much. That was awesome.
Reggie Watts performs tonight at 191 Tool in Tucson. And that'll do it for this Friday edition of the show. The show was produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, Ayanna Hamilton, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shout is our digital editor, Chad Snow, the news director. The show was created by John Hoban. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman. For Sam Dingman, I am Mark Brody in Phoenix. Thank you, as always, for being along. Have a terrific rest of your day. Have a great weekend. Hope to have you right back here on Monday.